Today, February 7th, 2007. Welcome, everyone. And first of all, I want everyone to know that Senate Bill 337 is a bill, OHSU's bill, actually, and they are not ready to testify on it, and so they will be put in the queue. So take 337 off. And also, Senate Bill 229, we were to have amendments, and no one submitted the amendments. So I submitted the amendments that I thought they were supposed to have, but also the Board of Psychological Examiners and the Association are going to get together and propose amendments, too. So that will be scheduled for whenever we get the amendments back, and hopefully that'll be soon. So that's off. But I would now like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 341, and would like to call Vicki Walker to the stand, and I'll turn the gavel over to Senator Cruz and let him gavel us until this vice chair gets here.
Madam Chair, I do know that the vice chair is in a meeting with her district.
Yeah.
It's quite an honor to have two of my chairs let us stand together. So, Senator Walker.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Did you want your committee administrator to
talk
about the bill?
Thank you. I'm just a newcomer here. Please go ahead.
Senate Bill 341 requires healthcare facilities that perform organ and tissue transplants to become accredited, and the tissue bank and the personnel who work at the tissue banks to become accredited by certain organizations.
Thank you.
Wow.
Okay, now.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. I'm honored to be here. I feel like you're so far down there. I'm honored to be here with Senator Monica Anderson today on this bill. This issue came to my attention in June of 2006 when I read an article by the Associated Press entitled, In Body Part Business, It's Patient Beware. You have a copy of it now at your dais. Additionally, in August of 2006, there was an article by the AP medical writer on FoxNews.com called Industry Sees Second Tissue Scandal in Year. You also have that at your desk. So given that I was a little bit busy during the interim, and given that my colleague seated to my left is an expert on healthcare, I gave her these articles and I said, let's do something about this. So she has aptly done so. Why am I concerned about the body part business? Because it is an industry that is out of control and unregulated. Currently, we have problems because the federal government, the federal agency responsible for tissue safety, the Food and Drug Administration, they're quite aware of the problems. They actually did a report in 2001, and they estimated that 519 cases of serious heart inflammation, 207 deaths occurred each year from fungus-contaminated heart valves.
Wow.
That's just heart valves. We have other instances where a 23-year-old student from Minnesota died of a raging infection after he came, the cartilage that was used on his surgery came from a corpse that had sat unrefrigerated for 19 hours, a corpse that had been rejected by two other tissue banks. The FDA is of the opinion that the industry should regulate itself. I disagree strongly. There are several cases. Both articles will cite people who get into the tissue trading industry under nefarious conditions, and they are not honest about where their tissue comes from. They will contract with funeral homes and take tissue from funeral directors without any understanding of what this person died of. There are reasons that tissue banks are, that there are accredited agencies to cover tissue an organ transplant because you don't want to be transplanting an organ or a tissue that had cancer into someone else, or HIV, or other things that are critical to understanding before you go sticking it in a person, a healthy person. So these are really tragic circumstances. Whether Oregon has had any of these, I'm not sure. I'd hope to hear from the department about that. But what I want to do is prevent this before it happens in Oregon. And that's simple, and I'm a very simple way to do that. And I'm going to let Senator Monis Anderson talk about the technical aspects of how we can do that. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Senator Walker, in all of these reports of problems, when you mentioned funeral homes, I'm wondering if they're harvesting organs and tissue from people who have not consented to being donors.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that is indeed the case. In fact, Masterpiece Theater host Alastair Cook had his body part plundered without his family's permission. And that was through the biomedical tissue services case, a now defunct New Jersey company. That was a very tragic case. There were several charges brought in that case, and the business was closed down. A former dentist was involved in that, and he faces other charges in that scandal. The case that you see in the long AP article here is a man who had no credentials at all in medicine. He just decided that this was a way to make a fast buck, and I would say that that's not what we're going to do in Oregon.
I'm sure just follow up. I mean,
certainly.
If a kid, I mean, I'm an organ donor, and I think it's appropriate, and hopefully they wait till I'm dead to harvest. But although there's some I don't anyway. But I guess it just, you know, that's a decision a person can make for themselves, whether they think it's appropriate, and for people to be going in and actually stealing organs or tissue from somebody who, for whatever reason, doesn't want that to happen, I think is insidious. So,
Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, I agree with you. There are donated cadaver tissue is used in more than a million procedures each year, and most of these operations do a lot of good. But there should be some regulation about that. One, there needs to be permission from the family that they can use your donated tissue, and I, too, am an organ donor, though I have limited what they can harvest from me just out of personal preference. But also, you need to know as a patient, you should know whether they're going to use cadaver tissue on you. You should have that option to have your doctor explain to you that during this procedure, we're going to use cadaver tissue, cartilage or whatever. If we don't use it, here are the alternatives. So that's another area where you can protect yourself. But I would like Senator Monis Anderson to talk about how we could protect ourselves as a regulatory agency here in Oregon.
Yes. Good morning, Vice Chair.
Good morning.
And members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Monis Anderson from Gresham, Fairview, Troutdale, and Wood Village. And before I go into the technical aspects of Senate Bill 341, I want to follow up with Senator Cruz on the harvesting. There is a practice in China, it has been proven, of harvesting organs from innocent prisoners of conscience. And I feel that's a crime against humanity. This is a billion-dollar business, and it's huge. And I'm not sure what they've done. There is a report on allegations of organ harvesting of Falun Gong practitioners in China that was published in July of 2006. So this is a problem there, but I'm sure, I would hope, that we aren't using illegal tissue here in the state. But like Senator Walker said, this is a prevention bill. We will get it into statute. Basically, the bill does four things. The
First of all, and I've talked to OHSU, and that's the only hospital I talked about. They do a number. In fact, I actually talked with a surgeon who actually does transplants. We happened to be on a plane together, so it was ironic that he was does transplants, and I was trying to pass a bill. He says, "Oh, we don't have a problem in Oregon," and the. They are following exactly what this bill says, and we just want to make sure everyone else does. So, basically, number one, the tissue or organ transplant, it has to take place in an accredited health facility, accredited by the Joint Commission on Accreditation of Healthcare Organizations, also known as JCO. Very easy and straightforward. Second, it's a healthcare facility that performs transplants must use the organ procurement organization that serves Oregon. And I was hoping the department would be here today to give us a little background on that, but they are very much in favor of the bill, and I'm sorry I can't go into who our procurement organization is, although we do have, it's called Northwest Tissue Bank, I believe, and I assume that's the one we're using. And a tissue bank must be accredited by a scientific nonprofit national organization approved by DHS. And the example that Senator Walker with the 23-year-old that developed a raging infection due to the cartilage, that cartilage came from an unregulated and non-accredited tissue bank. And so that's the reason for number three. We want to make sure that every tissue or an organ will come from an organization approved by DHS, a national organization. And then finally, the tissue bank personnel must be certified by a scientific nonprofit national organization approved by the department. And again, the national organization provides the training for organ transplant specialists, I believe they're called. So that's basically what the bill does. We certainly don't want infections happening in Oregon. I don't know if there have been any yet, but this bill will certainly discourage it. And we want every provider who does transplants to be prohibited from buying from unaccredited suppliers that offer tissue or organs, because usually those are the ones that you can get them quicker and cheaper. And we also want the personnel who handle these tissues. The fact that that cartilage was left unrefrigerated for 19 hours should never have happened. We just want high standards. So that's my testimony. Any questions?
Questions or comments for Senator? Senator Carter. I am very glad to see this legislation before us, because when this business has just gone amok, and the amount of dollars in it, certainly when you see how they started, and they are now at over 3,000 companies in this country, and you can afford to pay your chief executive officer $500,000 because you're making so much money in the business. It just tells me that when people are dying from this kind of thing, nobody, you know, you can't have the fox minding the hen house. You just can't do it. And so these people are not going to regulate themselves as long as this kind of money is in the business itself. So I think that for Oregon to do something about this so that our people are not left at risk, I think is very important. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members, for presenting this legislation.
Further comments from the panel?
Yes, thank you. I would just like to leave you with this comment from the AP writer, Marilyn Marchion. I think that's how she pronounces it. I just think she's done the United States a great service by talking about this issue and investigating it. She spent 3 months on this, but she says here, at every step, from funeral homes where the journey often begins to hospitals and doctor's offices where it ends with patients receiving the eyes, bones, skin, and other parts of the dead, poor oversight invites abuse and creates danger. So that's, and I just got shivers when I said that, because I think about all these people who have died because they have had body parts that have not been protected from germs or taken care of in a way that they should be scientifically. And as I said, there's a million transplants and use of body parts every year, over a million, and it is a good use all of us in the afterlife, I suppose, but we do need to protect us, and I think Oregon should be on the forefront of making sure that we do that, because certainly the federal government isn't doing it.
Well, we thank Senator Walker and our chair, Senator Mons Anderson, for bringing forward this good public policy. Are there additional folks signed up to testify? All right. We will pass the gavel back to the chair.
I would like to know the pleasure of the committee. I'm talking with the department. There may be a small fiscal in getting this information to all healthcare facilities that perform transplants, whether it's tissue or organ. And so that is not before us. But I certainly can we move a bill without having the fiscal before us?
All right. Is LFO coming forward with a fiscal? Have they had a chance to review this?
I technically can move it, but it's up to the
question. I would prefer to wait.
Yes, if you would, please.
Yes.
And then we can
okay.
go. Otherwise, we get ourselves in this awkward situation.
Yeah. We will then get a fiscal, please. Shannon, thanks so much.
Madam Chair,
yes.
In addition to the fiscal and any other written testimony that the department might wish to submit would also be helpful, just so that we have a complete record of the importance of this public policy issue.
I see the department representative. Is it possible to just give a statement of where you are on this bill? Okay. Thank you. Yes.
May I? I would like I'd like to ask the department a question.
Yes.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm the government relations person for the Public Health Division at the Department of Human Services, and I have our healthcare licensing and certification manager here today with me.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Senator Gordley. My name is Ron Prinslow. I'm the manager of a small work section called Healthcare Licensing and Certification, located in State Public Health, and we currently have a neutral stance on this bill. Although I am a firm supporter of regulatory oversight, I've been doing this for 20 years, and feel strongly that you can't really have too much oversight of healthcare. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. My question is: in the art of collecting data, is it not a part of your mission? I haven't looked at the statute. Is it a part of your mission to be able to gather data from all components of healthcare where you feel as if there might be a danger?
We are, I have to say that we're understaffed and we're underfunded, and we have been for years. And currently our mission is very limited. About 70% of our budget comes from Medicare certification. That's one of our main missions. The other 30% comes from, is fee supported. And in that, we go out and do regulatory oversight in the way of surveys. But I have to say that those facilities, the major hospitals that perform transplants, they're all accredited by the Joint Commission, and as such, I don't have access to those hospitals except when there's a complaint. So in many hospitals, unless there's a complaint, we have not been in those hospitals for years. Although in statute we do have the ability to go in, we do not have the funding or the staff to go in. So I have limited knowledge. So usually the only way we get into one of those hospitals is when we have a complaint. We do have some oversight through Medicare for transplant programs that deal with kidneys.
That was going to be my next question. Since a portion of your budget comes through Medicaid, if even if you were to check around Medicaid patients who were having transplants, don't you have the authority to do that and some resources, though limited, to be able to do that?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, there is a piece of work that's coming forward from Medicare. I don't have the details yet, but it does involve transplant centers.
Okay.
I believe it's being piloted like in a dozen states right now, and then I believe it'll be rolled out to the rest of the states at some point. So I think they do have an intention, although I think they're in the same position we are. They do not have the funding. And if that actually happens or not, you know, whether we'll actually go out and look at some of these other transplant centers. Because honestly, I don't even know how many transplant centers there are in Oregon, how many tissue banks. I just don't have that information. I would be glad to collect it if I had the funding and staffing to do it.
Is there, excuse me, ma'am. Interesting. That is more than interesting and quite scary, quite frankly.
It is. To be quite honest, you know, we have some major loops or holes in our oversight functions as far as healthcare goes, and this is just one of them. And usually it doesn't come to light until there's some type of major problem that shows up on the front page of the newspaper.
That's right.
I think if you remember a number of years ago, there was a heart transplant problem that went astray at Oregon Health Sciences University. And, of course, that got splashed over the paper. But essentially, that's the only way we get involved in these things. You know, at that point, we did go out and investigate what happened there, you know, what happened that there was an error. And actually, I think that was in blood typing, you know. But, it's an uncomfortable position to be in sometimes, yes.
Mr. Manager, one more question. Mm-hmm. I don't mean to put you on the spot or anything of that nature, but if you were to guesstimate, and I want the record to show guesstimate, how much you think you would need to collect the data in terms of the number of kidney companies and transplant companies in Oregon. Just off the top of your head, just kind of guess me how much, because it would give us an idea, Madam Chair, in terms of what kind of resources that we're talking about.
I hesitate in providing that information. I know that we did put forward yesterday at 2LFO. A $20,000 figure. And unfortunately, I was in band attending a meeting at St. Charles Hospital, so I did not really get a chance to have much input into that $20,000 figure. So I don't know how solid that is. I think, you know, I'd have to go back and look at it. It really depends on the number. You know, how many, you know, once you determine how many centers are out there, then it would lead you to how much staff time would be involved.
Okay.
But I would think right now we could collect some basic data.
Good.
At least the number, you know, and also maybe have some type of process to have complaints come in.
Okay.
For the 20,000.
Okay.
But I'd have to go back and check.
Katie, this, if she's going to direct us to Ways and Means, it's going to come to my committee, and these are the kind of questions I'm going to be asking you guys. So get ready in terms of some data to come, because I feel very strongly. Just reading about the kids from Minnesota is enough to make everybody in this legislature want to do something. A 23-year-old vibrant kid with just a minor surgery on his knee, and he dies from some level of fungus. I mean, that is irresponsible.
Madam Chair and Senator Carter, looking at the bill, it says that DHS would be required to adopt rules and to make sure that these facilities are appropriately certified. If there's an expectation that we're going to do enforcement and surveillance and take on a more active role, then we'd have to take another look at this bill.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I wanted to just know what was happening in Oregon, and I felt every healthcare facility needed to be because we didn't have the information. And I think, though, this is something that we're going to definitely need to expand once maybe we get some preliminary results from the department, unless, you know, someone wants to add an amendment to this. But we established the Patient Safety Commission, was it 2 or 4 years ago? And hospitals are not required to report infections. And so that is what's scary. And we were hoping that something would come out of the Patient Safety Commission regarding that. And until we can get to... we don't want to be punitive at all, and I think that some of the cases that have been brought to the Patient Safety Committee have actually helped. I think that, now this is hearsay, has actually decreased or at least improved the process in the hospital. So there's a lot of work in this area, but when we talk about cost containment, I mean, in a sense, I see this as a cost containment bill, because if we can cut down the number of infections, then we cut down the cost of health care that's needed for these patients who are getting infections due to the health care.
Madam Chair, yeah. I think if I was Senator Cruz and I was having a knee surgery, I'd certainly want you to be on top of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Madam Chair,
yes.
I'm wondering at this point, and Patient Safety Commission is a good comparator, I think, and we are starting to get results. When we created that, we knew it would take some time to get everybody comfortable with the fact that they could share information. And I think that in the next decade we'll see some incredibly positive results out of that legislation. I'm wondering, Madam Chair, at this point, especially knowing that it's going to go to Senator Carter's subcommittee, if we might need to be taking a serious look at the resources to make this happen. I'm not sure 20,000 gets us very far, and maybe we ought to be sending it to Ways and Means just so it's on her agenda.
Well, my intent was, since it was under $50,000, for it to go to the floor, but any kind of physical ends up in Ways and Means, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's,
you know,
right. Yeah. Whether it's 20,000 or 50,000,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. All right. Well, the Patient Safety Commission, I think, is an extremely important commission, but we don't fund it adequately at all. And so that is another issue, that they want to do a lot of good work, but they have no funding to really carry out the directive that we as a legislature have given. So I think there is a bill out there somewhere looking at funding for the Safety Commission this time, which I know will end up in your committee. So I think this all blends together. All right. So we'll probably be working this once we have the fiscal and your statement next week, if we can get that from you.
Okay, we'd be glad to do that, Madam Chair. And just to let you know that we're fine with taking on the responsibility of developing the new rules and making sure that the tissue transplant agencies are certified appropriately. So that's what statement will say.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Yes,
I'm grateful that they are, but just establishing rules without teeth
won't
necessarily get us anywhere.
Okay. I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 341, and I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 340. And I apologize to the committee on this. This bill, do you want to describe the bill, Shannon?
Sure. Senate Bill 340 would prohibit minors under the age of 14 and under from using tanning devices at tanning facilities, and it imposes civil penalties on tanning facilities.
And the intent of this bill was to raise the limit with the amendments to 18. But what we did find in the process, by rule, people under the age of 18 need to be with a parent or guardian in person to get permission to use a canning booth. And so the intent of this legislation was accomplished, but it was already in rule, and I apologize for bringing this forward. But I think that it would be helpful to call Terry Lindsay and Gail Atterbury up to the podium to just give us a little bit of a summary of what they've.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Lindsay. I'm the manager of the Radiation Protection Services section in the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Public Health Division. And I'm here to answer questions regarding Senate Bill 340.
I was wondering if you knew how, if you tell us about your inspection process.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, in terms of our inspection process for the last 14 years since the original legislation was adopted from House Bill 3088 in 1991, we have been inspecting tanning salons, average about 240 salons per year, and there's a total of about 715 salons that are operating in the state at this time. So they're on a three-year cycle in terms of inspections. And during the process, in terms of related to minors, one of the things that we do have done since the inception of this rule in 1992 is evaluate whether or not there are minors that are allowed to tan. And we made a change in the rules in 1994 to require parents actually be present in the salon, come into the salon and sign in the presence of the owner-operator. What was happening prior to that time is kids would sign off and or have a friend sign off and come in and this is my mom, and it really wasn't. So they go through an identification process. Kids are kind of clever. And it also is a liability for the salon in terms of entering into a contract. Anyone who's a minor cannot enter into a contract, and that's part of the reasoning also in terms of for their liabilities. Also what's required in the rules is that they have an approved client card. And in the client card, it requires them to ask a series of questions. And part of the questions relate to medications, because there's many photosensitive medications. If you get medications, it's marked right on the prescription. There are medications that are up to 40 times more photosensitive. So the impact on immune systems is tremendous if you're on one of these medications. The best ones to check with, and that we advise in our training program, is to check with a pharmacist or the family doctor. So we're assured that they know that they're looking at a scientific person that knows whether or not this is a photosensitive medication or not. This is something that the operator shouldn't be giving advice on. They should send them to the pharmacist or send them to the family doctor. And we also teach them in the training sessions how to evaluate skin types. And the lighter the skin type, the easier they can get burns and the higher incidence of potential skin cancer in the future. So Norwegian that I am, I am skin type 2, and I can tan a little bit, but I can also burn very easily. I also freckle. So in the consent cards, there's also requirements in there to put in information about contact lenses. We don't want contact lenses melting onto the eyes. They are required to have eye protection. and that warning is on all of the client cards that we approved. Also, the lips need to be protected during exposure, so they use an SPF 15 minimum in terms of on the lips when they're tanning. All of those are covered in the client disclosure and consent cards that are approved by the department. In each time they go in, they actually sign and initial the customer themselves, initial the amount of time that they're authorized to get. And in the approval of a tanning device, which is a medical device, the FDA requires that they post a schedule right on the tanning bed that tells by skin type how much time they're allowed as they start up in the process, and then as they develop a tan, it extends more time in minutes in terms of the amount of time that they're allowed to tan. And if they follow those schedules, they don't get burned, and that's the critical part of development of skin cancer, is the burns, especially early in life. And that's where we supported the original legislation in terms of under age 14 or 14 and under, that the earlier you are in terms of getting a burn, the more chance there is of developing skin cancer later in life. So,
further questions? Thank you, Ms. Atterbury.
Well, I know I'm tantalizing you by being here. And
no, you're not.
First of all, I'd like to say that I cannot. I am here as a parent. It is difficult for me to
introduce yourself. Yeah.
My name is Gail Atterbury, and I am the director of Oregon Right to Life, but I am not here as Oregon Right to Life. It's hard for that to be. So I'm here as a parent, and also I'm here delighted to withdraw my opposition, because my opposition was going to be towards the amendment which would restrict this 15 to 18 year olds from being able to participate, because there was a parental consent form that needed to be signed, and I had not heard that in any of the testimony before, and I saw this amendment being made, and I thought, wait, parents already need to be informed. So I have no opposition to this now that that's all I have discovered that. So thank you, Senator Rona Sanderson and committee.
Well, it was a surprise to me, too, and because I was the one that introduced the legislation. So now we do know. All right. Any other? Yes,
yeah,
Senator Courtney.
I know the bill is going nowhere, but I have some questions. Your testimony confuses me. We had testimony last week from the American Cancer Society that certain forms of skin cancer are highly curable. Other forms, like melanoma, they'll kill you. And that the serious form of skin cancer, melanoma, which is also the most common cancer diagnosed among young adults. So melanoma, which kills you, is the most common form of skin cancer among young adults. Let me just finish. That's what it said here. Then it was go on to say that the risk factors, excessive sun exposure, sunburn history, and the use of tanning beds. And the exposure to the UV radiation, which is what causes skin cancer. Now, where I'm confused on this whole area is, aside from consent or no consent, a parent's consent will not reduce UV radiation if you're exposing to the sun.
Right.
It will not reduce the risk of melanoma. And we don't allow or call for parent consent regarding kid getting cigarettes 18 or under. You just don't get them. Alcohol, you don't get them. This is the year of healthy kids. If this poses a serious threat to young people getting whatever form of skin cancer, the kind that's curable, of which I myself have had, and constantly having my head burned or other parts of my burn by my dermatologist. My wife's had surgeries as well. Or melanoma, which can kill you. Then why shouldn't we just say we're not going to allow 18 or younger tanning booths exposure to young people? Is it not as serious in a way as smoking or alcohol, which we ban? We don't say consent of adult or not consent. There is the exception, I suppose. They say if there's some medical need, and that would require a physician's intervention and restrictions in terms of even the testimony and cancer size. So although the bill is not going forward, I am confused on this issue, comparing it to alcohol as well as tobacco in terms of state policy as well as other state policies. We say no. We're not going to allow tobacco products in our kids of our hands. At least I think we say no, 18 or under, maybe it's older. And we even go further with alcohol.
That's right.
Why wouldn't we say the same for tanning booths? If it's a threat to life and death, they say it is.
Senator Mons Anderson, Senator Courtney, members of the committee. In terms of the tanning industry, in terms of the difference between direct exposure out in the sun and direct exposure in the tanning booth, it is similar. The difference may be in the controlled exposure. In other words, the timing is regulated by the current regulations, and in terms of the design of the tanning booths themselves as medical devices, the amount of exposure time is critically set. One of the things that we've done as an improvement in terms of for the regulations, since the early inspections were done in the 92, 93, 94 time frame, is we had trouble with timers. Timers were sticking, kids were getting burned, adults were getting burned, and one of the things we required is that all timers have to be remotely controlled. They have to be controlled up at an operator station rather than in the tanning booth. And what this does is it removes the possibility of a timer failure. We also test it in all cases to make sure that the timers are accurate, and we actually resulted in a federal recall of two timers that were made in France as part of our testing process. And it resulted in about 100 tanning beds being required to have the timers replaced on them. To answer the question in terms of does this UV exposure not pose a danger to minors or anyone else, there's also always a danger in terms of the UV exposure, whether it's outside in the sun or in the tanning booth. But it's the burns that are critical in terms of development of skin cancer. And in the earlier it is in life, and that's where I'm worried in terms of I was out in the sun on a farm many, many years ago, and that I may develop skin cancers from that exposure, 50 years ago. And I think it's the same kind of concern that a lot of people that are in the outdoors would have in terms of exposure that they had as a young person. For the use of the tanning beds, it's in a controlled time environment that should help to lower that overexposure.
I'm not going to pick on you, Madam Chair, because it's not fair, and I really don't mean to. Unfortunately, you're just at the wrong place at the wrong time. So if our young people, it sort of reminds me, if our young people smoke but don't inhale, we'll let them buy cigarettes. And if they drink but promise to only drink at home, we'll let them buy alcohol. I'm sorry, I'm lost, this thing. The bill's going nowhere. But I am remarkably amazed at our philosophy on what is clearly a danger that comes about later on in life, and it's a living hell when it gets you. And we know it. And so I got confused, I guess. I guess the testimony of the American Cancer Society, which was very dramatic and very uncontested, clearly put this right along with tobacco and alcohol with me. In fact, maybe even more so in some areas. But I thank you. I didn't mean to pick on you, and if I have been too harsh, I forgive me. It's just that we're making an issue of healthy, making sure our kids are healthy in terms of what they eat, in terms of providing for their health needs. And clearly, in this day and age, where there are the tattoos and all this what makes you look beautiful, and I've got bills in on PE and steroid use, and everything's on appearance, and that makes you attractive. So we'll tan up. I'm sorry. This stuff is dangerous, and it is deadly, whether Mother Nature sticks it in you or whether a human nature. We know that the skin can get into serious trouble. So enough of me, Madam Chair. Right. I'm done. I've lost.
As you can tell, Peter Courtney, Senator Courtney, has lost. But we had a lively debate. A lively debate with a lot of different senators, and there was the viewpoint of Ms. Atterbury's and then the viewpoint of Senator Courtney, and there was definitely conflict on whether we should just ban it totally or not. But maybe next time around we can get there.
Probably not.
All right.
Thanks.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. And no other further testimony or comments? All right. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 340, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 163.
Madam Chair, may I make an introduction?
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'd like to acknowledge two students from Portland State University in our audience this morning, Megan Clay and Alexis Romanos. They are both interning in my office. They are Department of Black Studies students at Portland State University, and they are having a great experience this session.
Yeah. Okay. Shannon, would you give a summary, please?
Madam Chair, I just want to say something to to Senator Cordner. You're right, that bill was going nowhere, but it's just another instance of how remarkably irresponsible we can act as a legislature in protecting our children. And it really saddens me to know that we spend billions of dollars in health care. We spend, I don't know how many dollars in regulating the liquor industry. We spend three times the dollars regulating and visiting stores for cigarettes, tobacco usage, and knowing all of those things are detrimental, but we let this one go by. I find it very interesting. Don't talk to me about cost containment. Don't talk to me about anything else. Talk to me about children's living, and talk to me about how healthy they live for a certain period of time before something like this just grabs a hold of them. I find it irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. Before we start with people are going to testify, I want to read into the record. You'll see in your packet, Mid Valley Behavioral Care Network sent testimony on Senate Bill 163, and that they are the leader of the Oregon's Mental Health Organization, which provides mental health services for the Oregon Health Plan members throughout the state. Okay, with that, Walter Schaefer?
Yes.
Okay.
And are we going to have a summary of the...
Yes, please.
Senate Bill 163 permits the exchange of protected health information between health service organizations and the state health plan, and allows the health care providers to communicate about the client in order to provide integrated health care for that client who's receiving treatment from two different care providers.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Walter Schaefer. I'm the medical director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs at DHS, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 163. My primary purpose today is to introduce the bill. I've provided some written testimony, and I just want to emphasize a couple of points in that regard. The integration of behavioral health care and physical health care is actually one of the highest priorities at DHS at this time. We've started a series of efforts between the Division of Medical Assistance Programs and the Addictions and Mental Health Division and Public Health Divisions, activities that break down barriers that we identify to integrated, coordinated, unified care. And this year, DHS is expecting each of the mental health organizations and each of the managed care organizations that provide medical care to OHP clients, each of those to develop collaborative projects, either starting or advancing combined systems of care. And one of the barriers that we've found in initiating these efforts is a restriction on the exchange of information in the current state statutes. The policy on mental health information in particular is more restrictive, and at times that creates situations in which mental health organizations are reluctant to provide release patient information to medical plans. So Senate Bill 163 seeks to clarify that the exchange of protected health information is allowed in the specific context of mental health organizations and medical care organizations working together. We can go into some of the details of the particular types of information, but I can leave that for questions. I just basically would summarize and say that this bill is a reasonable, appropriate step and limited step in decreasing one of the barriers that we have to this type of integration. So I'm willing to answer questions, and thank you for the opportunity to introduce this bill.
Any questions? Why don't you just stay there? Let me, Pam Maria Nason. Is it Maria?
It's Maria.
Maria. I know you've told me that a dozen times, but Maria.
It's not an easy one.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee. My name is Pam Marianason, and I'm here from CARE Oregon. But this morning I'm actually representing the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is a group of the 11 of the fully capitated health plans providing services to these members. So I'm going to make sure and be specific in our testimony. We are committed to ensuring our OHP members have access to high-quality health care and believe that coordinating with our behavioral health partners is essential to improving services to consumers and achieving optimal health outcomes. There's a wealth of information that supports the need to bridge this gap, and information about the patient is a part of that gap between behavioral and physical health care, particularly for individuals with severe and persistent mental illness or emotional disturbances. Senate Bill 163 is the foundation upon which collaboration begins, as it provides a streamlined mechanism for mental health and managed care providers to share health information about individuals served by both. However, the current language of this bill could be interpreted to apply only to organizations that provide both behavioral and physical health care services, and that's line 10 through 12. COHO believes that the language should be broadened to enable separate as well as integrated behavioral and physical health managed care providers who serve the same individuals to share clinically relevant information. Partnerships between behavioral and physical health providers may take many forms, from collaboration to full integration, and we believe that the organizational relationship between the two entities should not dictate nor be a barrier to sharing such information. So as such, we propose the following language changes on line 11 and 12. And you can see basically it's just taking out the word integrated and including behavioral and or physical health care services to the individual. Clearly, we've talked to the department about this, and they are supportive of this amendment. You could certainly talk to Dr. Schaefer. And thank you for the opportunity to testify. We think this is a very important bill, and obviously I'll be happy to answer any questions.
And are you representing PacWest? Did you propose this amendment?
I am not representing PacWest. I'm representing...
Bring PacWest up here, too. So yeah, I know you didn't sign up. But there is an amendment that needs to be submitted, requesting language that I believe makes the very same changes that you said. And so I want everyone to be on the same page so I don't run into the same thing that happened on an earlier bill today. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Becker. I'm the executive director of COHO. Actually, PacWest works for me. I'm not part of PacWest.
Okay.
They are our legislative relations firm for COHO. And through PacWest, we have offered an amendment to the bill, which is in legislative council, the exact same amendment.
Okay. And I need to have Mr. Schaefer please let me know what your have you seen the amendment?
Yes, I have, Madam Chair. And in fact, I've discussed it with other people at the Addictions and Mental Health Division and at DMAT, and we're supportive of the amendment. The original wording had some lack of clarity in as to whether this was a single organization that was providing both behavioral and physical health care, and that really wasn't the intention, because generally there'll be more than one organization that's providing behavioral and physical. So the amendment does clarify that and doesn't interfere with that type of integration and coordinated care that we're trying to promote.
Great. Well, then, as soon as we have, and they've been submitted to legislative council, so we may be, if there's no further discussion,
Madam Chair,
yes.
I just wanted to say, we
for all of us who, for the last 25 years, been working on this issue, we do not intend to recreate a bifurcated system. That's the whole reason that we, many of us, have been fighting so long, and that is that I don't know how you can separate the head from the body. So when you talk about behavioral health versus physical health, that has done too much damage in the state and in this nation. So having the language that solidifies all healthcare institutions would look at this as a single source system in making sure that we are responsible in terms of behavioral health as well as physical health is the intent. So I'm very glad to see this amendment here, and will be very much in support of it.
Great. Any other further questions? Then probably we'll be hopefully work sessioning this next week as soon as we get the amendment, and that is agreeable to everyone.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, with that, I would like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 163, and I do want to let the committee members who were not at Mount Hood Community College, we had a very good visit, learned a lot about Head Start and the needs of child care, talking about healthy kids, and the issues that were important to Gresham. So any other further comments? With that, the meeting's adjourned.